This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Here's what Senate President Martin Looney had to say last Thursday after lawmakers passed a new two-year state budget.
We had, I believe, a very, very successful 2015 session and passed what is, for the state of Connecticut, a historic budget.
But not everyone agrees. State business leaders have attacked the plan for raising corporate and personal income taxes, claiming irreparable harm to Connecticut's economy. For his part, Looney said that the criticism, especially from General Electric, the state's biggest company, if not its biggest in-state employer, might be a bit overboard, especially for a company well known for not paying any taxes anywhere. He also suggested this might all be cover for already planned cuts. But it does seem that the narrative around the budget, which the governor wants to tout for its investments in transportation, has been squarely all about taxes and business climate. And the work is not done. The legislature heads back into special session. We'll see what happens there. It's Wednesday, so it means it's time for the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We'll also take a look at how another former top state lawmaker gets stuck in a revolving door. And we already had a contest to try to name Hartford's new minor league baseball team. Now we'll find out who's the corporate sponsor of the stadium. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us, for the first time in the wheelhouse, and I'm very excited, our friend Sue Haig, who is a political reporter for the Associated Press. She's been telling us stories about what's happening at the Capitol for years, and it's so good to see you, Sue. Thanks so much for coming
in. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also here, Dan Haar, columnist for the Hartford Courant, fresh off his bravura performance at the Wheelhouse Uncensored. Very nice, Dan, and it's good to see you once again.
I have to watch my language here.
You do have to. I'm glad we talked about that in advance. There's a lot to talk about what's in the state budget that passed, and a lot to talk about around business and taxes. But first, Sue, what exactly happened and what still needs to happen in this special session here?
Do you mean what did happen over the last 5 months or what happened in the last 5 days?
It's kind of an unfair question.
Really. It is kind of an unfair question. Well, first of all, what business still has to be done when they head back to special session?
Well, there are at least two budget implementation bills. It sounds pretty boring, but these are the bills that spell out a lot of the details of the budget, and they still have to be negotiated. One of them, I understand, was pretty close to being done. That one dealt with mostly human services type matters. And in those bills, you'll probably see some other legislation that didn't make it. They are talking about trying to put in some the governor's Second Chance Society legislation and also the excessive force legislation that had to do with police officers having body cameras. And also they'll probably do a bill that has to do with conveying land, state property, and you'll also have the bond package and school construction.
And so these are all things that get taken up as separate items, or we see some of these actually tucked into this implementer bill? I mean, that's one of the things we always talk about, this. How does this end up working? Because we saw really hundreds of pieces of legislation that there was some hope would get some action, and then we ran out of time by the end of the special session or the regular session. So do some of those end up in the implementer? Do they end up getting their own time on the floor?
Well, some of those will have their own time, the ones that were actually spelled out in the call of the session. But the implementers are those two that I mentioned, at least two. Maybe I assume that they won't have another one, but you never know. And that's where you'll see some of that stuff come back to life. Every year, lots of bills die. I mean, everybody thinks that it's a big surprise. But really, a lot of legislation dies every year. It doesn't even make it out of committee. But those implementers are what they will be negotiating over the next week or so. We still don't have a date yet as to when they'll be coming up. But usually these things, the special sessions actually last usually a day, maybe 2 days. You know, they have to decide whether or not the House and the Senate will go in at the same time, or maybe one might come in one day and one might come in the next.
It's not entirely sure when the special session starts. And we know right now the governor, I believe, is either on his way to or already in Paris for the Paris Air Show. And so I'm wondering, this isn't probably going to happen anytime in the next couple days.
I think he's in Washington today. He'll be in Paris on Sunday and Monday for the Paris Air Show. He doesn't necessarily have to be there to negotiate these things, so he has staff that will be doing it. But so far, we haven't seen too many folks walking around the Capitol. We usually see them moving in and out of rooms and negotiating, and it's been pretty quiet the past couple of days.
There's some reasons for that, too. One reason is a lot of people in the Capitol, even though they kind of know this scenario, a lot of legislators actually schedule their vacations for very quickly after the final bell, even though they might know there might be a special session. So at one point, I heard on closing night that Sharkey, the speaker, had pulled his caucus and that he didn't feel as though he could have an effective Democratic caucus until like July or something. Now, what Arasimowitz said, I think this is all three of us, you know, have to absorb this information under very blurry circumstances, around 11:58. But I think he said 2 weeks, that was sort of the window, that they were thinking about 2 weeks from the close of session. So that would be 1 week from today.
Okay, so 2 weeks. And Colin, I mean, at the end of the day, we still have some work left to do on these implementers, some of these other things that didn't have time before the end of the special session. We've had a week to look back at this, and we want to get to some of the fallout, as I suggested in my introduction. You know, an awful lot of the conversation about what this budget is all about is about new taxes. Is that really all this new budget is about?
Well, yes and no. I mean, look, the part of the problem with this budget is that, and I think legislators felt this way too. I mean, sort of frontline, sort of not the leadership, but everybody but the leadership, felt that one of the problems with this budget is that it really kind of had no direction. There was no clear goal. Nobody ever articulated to them at any point. I mean, the budget is always sort of a patchwork of contrasting agendas. But this time, people really felt a little bit lost in terms of what was happening. And there were some 11th hour surprises when, in fact, Governor Malloy really put his foot down about this idea of designating half a point of the sales tax for his transportation projects. And I know we'll talk about that a little bit more down the road in the show, I mean. But that sort of – that monkey wrenched a lot of numbers. So there were problems there. Is now the time to talk about this whole issue of the business tax, or are we –
I think now's as good a time as any to talk about the issue of the business tax. I know, Dan, you might have a thought or two.
Well, relating that to the special session and the implementers, taking a step back, the governor did say on Friday that he would be willing to reconsider some of these taxes. That's not a – implementer question. That's a negotiation going into the process question. And that's why I think a lot of people are questioning his jetting off to Paris. That said, he did go to Des Moines, Iowa to deliver a speech and Oklahoma City in the week of the final negotiations for the budget. So obviously he has a staff. He's capable of talking on the phone from wherever he is. Some people would rather he be away. But the point is that we're not just here talking about there seems to be the spirit of a session that didn't finish, even though it's just the implementers. It's more than just the implementers because of those business taxes.
I'm not sure if you can expect a rollback of a lot of these taxes, though. He did say that he was willing to probably make some tweaks. He said he was willing to sit down and meet with the Connecticut Business and Industry Association to talk about those things.
Actually, after the budget passed through the legislature, President and CEO of the CBIA, Joe Brennan, asked Governor Malloy for an emergency summit.
With the impact of some of the large companies reconsidering their ability to stay in Connecticut based on this budget and the impact that's going to have on hundreds and hundreds of smaller companies and thousands of employees from those small companies, I felt we had to do something, and I thought to request the governor to pull together a meeting with myself, the legislative leaders, and the governor just to get ahead of this thing a little bit.
Okay, so what exactly does this look like if it's not rolling back some of the taxes that are already baked into this budget? What does an emergency summit like this, what could it accomplish?
Well, they did make some changes when the tax package first came out, and they pared back some of the sales tax increases by like a half a percent. I think that there are some, and Dan can probably talk about this more, but some tweaks to the unitary tax, which I do not want to try to explain. But, who knows? I just don't know if there's going to be a full rollback. No one's really said that so far. They need this revenue.
I have so many things that I want to say, but I want to begin by saying, listen to this man. Listen to what he just said, and you can understand to a certain degree what's wrong here in the state of Connecticut. He thinks there needs to be a summit of the governor, the legislative leaders, and him. You know, that's who he named should be at that summit. I mean, so in other words, the interest of business in Connecticut would be represented. You wouldn't be represented. There's no one there, basically, unless you have the dim sense that your legislative leaders and your governor represent you. But, I mean, nobody else is going to be there. And I mean, I don't know. I'm apoplectic about this to a certain degree. I really think, and Danny and I may lock horns a little about this, I really think the way that this has been represented has been incredibly false. And there's almost an intellectual treason being committed by people like Brennan and Jeff Immelt from GE running around telling the rest of the country and that blowhard moron Joe Scarborough that there's something grotesquely wrong with the way business is taxed in Connecticut. And it's really the opposite is true. Let me just tell a quick story.
Sure.
That I heard yesterday. A legislator who will for now remain nameless was going around to manufacturers trying to kind of figure out what's going on here. The legislator's walking out of the – after a visit to a local manufacturer, and the CEO is complaining about taxes. And the legislator says, well, just out of curiosity, how much did you pay in business taxes last year? And, you know, he said, oh, we didn't pay any. You know, but our employees pay the income tax and the property taxes and the sales tax, so we feel pretty taxed. Well, in the last calendar – the last business year for which statistics are available, 58% of eligible corporations paid essentially nothing. They have to pay $250. There's an alternative minimum tax you have to pay. Sometimes if you have like a bunch of LLCs, you might have to pay – you know, 750 because you got three different ones or something. But they 58% paid zero. They basically claimed they didn't owe anything, any business tax, any corporate tax. Of the other 42%, the average reduction in liability was 25% because nobody pays the corporate rate, 7.5 or whatever it is. Nobody pays that because there's so many credits, so many exemptions, so many deductions. So when you really look at the tax burden here, I mean, there's a lot of ways to juke the stats, as they used to say in The Wire. But when you really look at the burden that businesses have here, I don't think it's a high one. Certainly, if you look at – because you can't look at what the rates are because they don't pay the rates. You have to look at what's collected. And when you look at what's collected and what and how it factors as a percentage of the government, if you look at all of the taxes, state and local, paid by businesses and corporations, it's 28.9%, I think, of the total revenue, of the total budget revenue, which is really, really low. It might be the lowest in the country. So who's making up that difference? In other words, if everywhere else they pay a larger percent of the budget, who's making up that difference? We are. That's why we're not going to be represented when Joe Brennan meets with the state legislators and the governor, because in fact the plan is for the companies to pay less and for the average citizen to pay more.
Mr. McEnroe, thank you very much. Danny Haar from the Hartford Courier.
There was so much said there that in order for me to sort of respond intelligently, I think in the spirit of the simplicity of the debate that we've had over the past 5 months and especially the past 2 weeks, I'm just going to give it a number. 6. On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd say 6 to that. For example, in the blowhard scale, I disagree about Joe Brennan. I think he's doing his job, what he's paid to do.
Well, I called Joe Scarborough. I called him.
Joe Scarborough, I agree with you, and Jeffrey Immelt.
I think he's got the morning off of Morning Joe. He's actually probably listening today. So hi,
that's
Joe.
Good. Hi, anyway, Joe. How are you? I agree with you. But as far as the first of all, I thought it was 2/3 that only pay $250. I'd seen the figure 2/3. But whatever it is, yes, it is high. The problem here is that the first law of sociology prevails, which is some do, some don't. And it really is a complicated question, not because this decision is good and this decision is bad. That seems to be the way that the debate is shaping up, but because we really don't know. We have 5 categories of business tax increases if you include the surcharge remaining in place, which goes from 7.5% to 9%. That's been in place since, I think, 2011. Mm-hmm. If you count those 5 categories, the problem isn't this one or that one is a bad tax. It's that we don't know.
Okay, we don't know, but the narrative, Danny, is that Connecticut has a higher tax burden than other places in the country, that we are doing irreparable harm to our ability to actually have a functioning economy here. It's what we hear year in and year out. Colin is essentially making the case that actually, if you take a look at the numbers, the tax burden for Connecticut businesses actually isn't as bad as they say it is.
And yes, I would add to that that a few years ago, I think sponsored by CBIA, Bloom Shapiro did a canvas of businesses about what they thought their biggest worry or problem was. I think 11% said the state tax burden. The state economy was their number one concern. And their economy, to your point, Danny, that's something that really –
Yeah, demand for goods and services should always be the number one concern. But as far as the taxes, you're referring to the Council on State Taxation report, and that's measuring the percent of a given jurisdiction of the state's tax burden. It doesn't measure the absolute. So the 28% in Connecticut is among the lowest. I think it's fourth lowest in the country. I forget. Bill Sebas had it in an op-ed. But it is also in the aggregate a pretty high number compared to a lot of states, because Connecticut simply spends more money because there's more income and more wealth here. And so it depends what you're looking
at. Yeah, you look at dollar amounts and
it's
higher.
It's high.
But I'm not sure how significant that is.
Well, it may not be, because we don't know the profitability of these companies. That's the issue.
Sue, what are you hearing from state lawmakers as they talk to constituents? I'm sure lots of people are banging on lots of people's doors saying, you guys are taxing us out of existence. What are you hearing from lawmakers? I mean, are they hearing back from their constituents about this tax package?
Mostly from their business constituents is what I've heard. And it's not just those that perhaps may pay the corporate income tax. I mean, this bill increases taxes on sort of a variety of different things. I mean, there's these surgical centers that are now going to be charged a 6% tax that hadn't been charged that before. These I guess they're all around the state. And
they didn't used to be there. They're all over the place
right now.
Yeah.
And they're talking about maybe 15 of them might have to close. They're hearing from car wash people that now are going to have to charge a tax for car washes. It's all these little tiny things that are affecting a whole bunch of different people different ways.
Dan?
I think we're conflating. You're not conflating. I think the debate is conflating a whole bunch of things when you put the IT tax, the computing tax, together with the car wash tax. If somebody has to pay 6.35% to get their car washed and they're pissing and moaning about that, why don't they just that just annoys me
but,
to
but
no
the,
end.
But this is the argument that you're making.
About,
yeah, the
we're talking about business tax. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, the argument that you're making in your columns about this is that there is a difference between taxing what you call the modern economy, whether it's an IT company or someone doing the new type of business that Connecticut wants to draw, and some of these other taxes. That is all fine and good. I guess the question is, overall, the narrative sounds like Connecticut is doing harm to its business climate again, and that is an across-the-board narrative. That's not just relegated to the car washes or the IT companies or General Electric. It's basically across the board. Everyone is saying that is happening. The question is that true? Is that really happening?
I think there's some truth to the fact that we're doing harm. The problem is that you have to tease out. First of all, you need money. The state needs money to run. Right. And the same cost study that referred to the percentage of taxes that come from business also referred to the percentage of spending that goes to business, which turns out to be really, really high. And all these, you know, open space, business loves open space, education, you know, all sorts of things that are really good for business are on the spending side of the budget as well in Connecticut. So we're a high cost state and that benefits businesses as well. But I just want to finish the point about the car wash. This is why it annoys me. Taxing car washes doesn't hurt the business climate in Connecticut. That's just nonsense. Taxing IT is the backbone of what businesses are doing. That's, you know, Unitel. You can make an argument about the corporations that are bringing money in being taxed as being a bad thing. Taxing car washes and things like that is not a problem.
Well, I'll sort of invert that, because I think there is a way you can invert it. First of all, I just want to say the IT tax is the one that I feel that I understand the least, and which I feel as though Danny might be right that it's more pernicious maybe than the legislators understood. I even heard that a little bit on closing night, that this really – we don't really know – even though it's really going from 1 to 2 or what – I mean, it was already there, right? Or
one to two to three.
1 to 2 to 3. That's right. Okay. So so there's that. Quick thing on the unitary tax, which Sue mentioned. The unitary tax, just to make it clear, one of the reasons that 58% or two-thirds or whatever it is of these companies don't pay any taxes is they just locate their revenue someplace else. They register their trademark in Nevada or something, or they have subsidiaries elsewhere in non-tax states that can basically collect their money. So they don't really – so they just say, well, we didn't really make anything in Connecticut. So the unitary tax is an attempt to look at that. Like, what do you really make here in the state? And so it really – they're doing sort of legalized tax evasion now. This is sort of an attempt to make honest people out of them. They don't like it. So
and Connecticut isn't the only state that would have a law like this. There's like a couple dozen states that have laws like this.
But I just wanted to just sort of say to Dan's point, and I think your point's an interesting one, but I think you could turn it on its head and say, I feel as though – the relief financial relief, tax relief, economic relief, you know, relief, help with health care and every other thing, property tax relief. If we're going to target it anywhere, target it at small business. Small business creates actual real jobs that stay in the state. One thing a car wash operator is not going to say is, I'm moving my car wash to North Carolina. He has a car wash here. So they're not going to play this Jeff Immelt game with us. And they really do create jobs that stay that aren't as transportable. So I'm on the side of small business here. I feel as though these big companies, they're just going to play chicken with us. They're going to play these games about where they're going to move stuff. You know, they have no loyalty whatsoever. They will go wherever they think they can get the best deal.
I don't think the question is small versus large. It is, does the business bring revenue from outside the state or does it not?
Mm-hmm. Okay, and just a last thought. Specifically, and you mentioned Jeff Immelt about General Electric, Colin, we play Martin Looney tape off the top. He's essentially saying they doth protest too much. You know, they're not going to move any place, or maybe they were going to move a bunch of jobs out of state, and they're just using this as cover. How much should we be scared about the biggest corporation based in Connecticut, if not the biggest employer, making threats like this?
I don't think we should be scared. I mean, first of all, like Dan was saying before, there are all these things we don't know. Like Dan was saying, we really don't know how all these different taxes on business come together. We don't really know how GE makes its decisions either. You know, I mean, I think it is quite possible that some of this is cover for moves that they were going to make anyway. And I feel as though we have been victimized by the Wall Street Journal and Joe Scarborough and GE and everybody else who's making this case based on flimsy evidence and poor research on most of their parts that Connecticut is a terrible place to have your business. I mean, there are a lot of things that militate against the effective running of business in this state. But I don't think they're reflected in most of the comments that have been made so far. And I think a disservice has been done to Connecticut by the hysteria, which became a national hysteria over this particular budget.
A last thought on this, Dan, before we move on?
I think that's a fair point, just as a disservice was made in Missouri after the Ferguson shooting.
Right. Well, but we didn't kill anybody.
No.
We just taxed
Wow. And now I have to take a break. We're talking with Dan Haar, columnist for the Hartford Courant, Colin McEnroe, who hosts the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. When we come back, we'll get some more details on what's happening at the state capitol with Sue Haig, who's a political reporter for the Associated Press. Join us at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's the Wheelhouse Hour Weekly News Roundtable. We're joined by Sue Haig, a political reporter for the Associated Press, Dan Haar, who's a columnist for the Hartford Courant, and our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts the Colin McEnroe Show, which you can hear each day at 1 o'clock on WNPR. What's on today's show, Colin?
Well, I should answer you in Esperanto, because the show is about Esperanto.
Can you do that?
I know I can.
I wish
but,
you would.
You know, Esperanto for a long time. I mean, we all love Humphrey Tonkin here in Connecticut, who is one of the world leaders in the Esperanto movement. But the Esperanto movement has been kind of this seen as this group of marginalized language nerds. But it's because of a couple of interesting new apps and because of things going on in hipster urban enclaves, Esperanto seems like it might actually become kind of cool. So that's what our conversation will be about.
Interesting conversation coming up at 1 o'clock with Colin McEnroe on the Colin McEnroe Show. Before I move too far away from all these tax plans, we were talking about the plans that are in the two-year state budget. Of course, lawmakers still have to come back for a special session and implement all this stuff. And, of course, there's a lot of complaints from the business community about what these new taxes will mean. But some of the stuff, Sue Haig, that's a little hard to understand has to do around property taxes and sales taxes, shifting money into a special transportation fund, which is something the governor really cares deeply about. We're going to be talking about transportation expansion in just a moment. But can you get your head around exactly what has been proposed and what's in this? Because the Democrats are essentially saying we're giving property tax relief. We're going to invest in this new transportation stream of funding. Explain to me, if you can, exactly how this all adds up.
Thanks.
Sue is never coming back here. This will be Sue's one and only appearance.
Now.
And this is actually something that the Democrats bring up and to counter the complaints from the business community. They said that we have made strides to try to address two problems that the business community has complained about for years, probably what everybody's complained about for years, transportation and high property taxes. So the plan is that of the 6.35% sales tax, 1% of it, that will be split in half, and half will go to the state's special transportation fund, which is the main account that takes care of roads, bridges, all that stuff, because that's projected to be in default a couple years down the road because we're not getting as much from the gas tax. The other half of a percent will that will take care of a cap on local car taxes. So they will have a cap, and if your town right now has a higher mill rate than that cap, then this money will make your town whole. They will some of these funds will go in there and cover that. There's also additional money in there for payment in lieu of taxes, grants that the state provides communities if they have certain untaxable property, like state parks or a prison, things like that. So that there, but there is, I've heard some concern from smaller communities that don't have these big payment in lieu of taxes grants. They usually don't get them, and they're concerned that they're going to be frozen at 2015 levels. And there's also some of this half of a percent supposedly is going to go to regionalization type efforts to try to fund those, and hopefully in the lawmakers' minds to make the state more efficient and cost efficient.
So we're splitting up all this 1%. I mean, one thing around this car tax thing that's I think important to understand is, while there's property tax relief coming back to the towns, there's also a slight rollback on the exemption that you can take when you file your taxes. So it used to be years ago, you get $500 that you could claim on your car. Now it's down to $300, and now that's going down. Anyway, so that is somewhat offset. This help that's coming back to the towns for property tax relief is somewhat being offset, right?
For the average property taxpayer, yes. They pushed it off until income year, I think. They push it off a year, so I guess that would be 2016, and it would go from 300 to 200. But then they also changed it too in terms of when you can take it, what your income level is. It's not just a done deal for everybody. It has to do with your adjusted gross income. So it's going to be a little bit more complicated. But that's
more complicated than that. Oh, excellent. That's
but that's more for the average taxpayer. I did talk to Connecticut Conference of Municipalities and the Connecticut group on small towns. What does the O stand for? Cost. I don't think that they are expecting communities to really drop their property tax rates anytime soon, because the state grants to cities and towns has been pretty flat for the last few years. But the way it was explained to me is this will help them maybe not raise taxes in the future.
Okay. So while we're splitting up this little tiny percentage, before we move on to the part that goes into the transportation fund, do you have a thought on this car tax piece, Colin?
Yeah, I think Danny and I agree more than disagree.
Ooh,
about
boy.
This for once. and so, I mean, I think this – look, it's an admirable effort. We should say my understanding about the process was that it was a full point – they were actually talking about a full point for this whole thing. And at the last minute, that's when Malloy jumped in and said, no, I need half of that for the dedicated transportation fund. But I have a couple problems with it. And maybe I should just let Dan afterwards explain why it's relief to places that desperately need the relief. And then it's also relief to places that don't need so much relief. But he could do a better job of explaining that. But actually, before I yield to Dan,
okay,
before I yield my time to Dan, let me just also say
– it's like a high school debate.
Right. But no, this is actually a place where I think I might be able to bring Dan along with me. I think there's sort of a blunt edge to this reform that I have a problem with. Okay, so a lot of this I think probably has to do with the fact that the governor really lives in Hartford for once. And so he understands, because his neighbors are telling him all the time, Hartford's mill rate is what? Like 71, right? It's like – garaging a car in Hartford is like buying a car most places. It's so incredibly expensive. So this reform is meant to write down that mill rate to 29 or whatever the cap is, which is great. But I think Dan and I would both agree that it kind of doesn't look at why is the mill rate 71 in Hartford? Some of it's because of untaxable properties. Some of it's because of just general urban problems. And some of it's probably bad mismanaged government, which is effectively being rewarded by writing their mill rate down just from 71 to 29. So how's that, Danny Hart? Am
well,
I Milton
great.
Friedman enough for you on that one?
I'm done. I don't have to speak. Just to be clear, the way this car tax relief works, at a cost of $85 million to the taxpayers, – The state, as Sue said, caps the amount. And it's important to note here, it is not the town that gets the money. The relief goes to the taxpayer. So that my neighbor who drives a Mercedes and lives in West Hartford, which happens to have a high mill rate, right, not because of poverty, but because soccer fields or whatever. So those neighbors that drive the Mercedes, and there are there are seven towns that have a high mill rate above 35 that also have a very high income: Bolton, Granby, Hebron, Simsbury, Woodbridge, Glastonbury, and West Hartford. And you may say that in exchange for giving relief to the poor car owners in all of the poor cities, which have all of them have high mill rates, that's a sort of a necessary evil. But the answer is towns can set their own mill rates for cars. There was an opinion from Blumenthal when he was attorney general in 2006 that said there's nothing in state law preventing towns from setting a lower mill rate for cars. So the city of Hartford can, in its wisdom, say we don't want to charge car owners 71 mills or 4 or whatever it is. We're going to charge them 30, right, which is a more reasonable rate, and that's going to give a break to car owners. But then they go to the state with their hand out, which they're quite accustomed to doing, and saying we need more money because we're performing a social good. And the state can say, you know what, you're right. OPM can say you're right. And we're going to add to the amount you get. And that way they can give money to the towns that perform this social good without giving money to Simsbury, Woodbridge, West Hartford, Glastonbury, and Hebron.
Okay. Well, you're saying in an ideal world that's how it would work,
that's
not how it works.
I'm saying that there's a solution without addressing the underlying problem, which is impossible to address, which you talked about.
I think I like your solution. But,
okay, right. So some more agreement. Let's get to this other little piece of this 1% here. So okay, now there's the transportation piece of it. The governor wants to put a certain amount into the special transportation fund. As you say, it's going to soon become insolvent. We've been hearing for years that money goes into the special transportation fund, then it gets raided for all sorts of other reasons. One key component to this, as I talked to administration officials about this, is if we don't have this so-called lockbox that the governor's been talking about, how do we know that any money that gets siphoned off of a sales tax is going to go to actually what we hope it's going to go to?
Hey, John, before Sue answers, when you say lockbox, I think it's important to explain exactly how a lockbox really works.
One of the keys to the lockbox would be kept by the president. The other key would be sealed in a small magnetic container and placed under the bumper of the Senate Majority Leader's car.
Yeah, you haven't done that to me in a while. I really appreciate that. So that's a good explanation from Al Gore of what he believes a lockbox is. So are we going to get a lockbox out of this special session, Sue?
That is so unfair. that's what they're talking about. There was a couple of dueling lockbox bills. And
that does sound exciting.
One the governor favored, which would not allow them to spend this money on anything but transportation. And the other one included a phrase called an escape hatch. And
I think
that's how it was described to me. And
he's got a clip from Lost actually coming up very soon for us. Anyway, please continue.
And that one would have allowed them to spend the money in case of an emergency. But that is – and there's this whole question of whether or not is a legislation necessary? Is that enough? Or do they need a constitutional amendment? And something like that would take a little bit of time to get something on the ballot. But yes, I think that will definitely be something that will probably come up in the special session.
So this is important, Colin, because – and we're going to talk a little bit in a moment about the Connecticut Fast Track expansion. And we've seen some good numbers so far from this busway project that's happened in Hartford. There's a lot that has to happen around trains and roads and bridges in the state. Governor Malloy has put a big bet down on this. But essentially, this revenue stream doesn't seem like it's going to fund everything that we really need to fix in our transportation world.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, if there isn't a real lockbox, I mean, there should be firing squads. After what we've just been through, what this actually did to the budget, if they're not serious about dedicating this fund and not touching it, I mean, there should be a citizen revolt about that. I look, at least at least this is kind of responsible thinking, right? You're going to have a transportation policy. Where's the money going to come from? I mean, it's the problem with it is that if you think of this as, you know, whatever percent it is of the overall state budget, the rest of the budget is treated like this drunk uncle who's just, you know, lurching around the kitchen at night, smashing into cookie jars and getting money wherever he can. And it's like, well, in this one area here anyway, we're going to make sure that we actually do follow some set of rules. But so I don't think there's a bad guy in the story. I mean, listen, I can't find a bad guy in the story. This seems to be the right idea. It had a pretty bad ripple effect on the budget when it sort of, you know, reared its head up in the 11th hour negotiations.
Dan?
Just to be clear, we're talking about a half a percent of the property tax is
Sales tax.
Tax is $210 million. So it's not, you know, in the face of a $30 billion transportation plan over the next 100 years, or is it 100 billion over whatever it is, it's
30 years.
$100 billion over 30 years.
Right. It's not a huge amount, but that's just so that we're clear about the amount we're talking about.
And also, this budget includes bonding. I mean, there's going to be a lot of bonding. And everyone should remember that the governor did put together a commission that's right now spending the summer coming up with ways to try to come up with other funding mechanisms, such as tolls. There's like a whole bunch of other possibilities out there.
And I want to talk about tolls in a second, but that's another one of the arguments that the governor's administration is making, is essentially that you can't bond for these projects unless you have a solvent transportation fund, unless you start to build this revenue stream. You can't actually go out asking for more money and borrowing more money to do some of this work, right?
Well, also that they make the argument, too, that this money that is needed from the sales tax would actually pay for more of the operating costs, the general upkeep, that type of stuff. That still needs to be paid for, and you need to have a reliable funding source. That's what they're saying.
So why is it – and we're talking with Sue Haig from the AP, our own Colin McEnroe, Dan Hart from the Hartford Courant. Why is it – and maybe this will come up in the special session. Maybe this will come up down the road. Why is it, Danny, when we're looking for money every single place possible – we don't have new gas taxes, and we don't have new toll taxes.
I don't know. It makes no sense. The toll, at least, is a new tax, which you might say we don't want to implement a new tax because, you know, God forbid, Malloy's promise would be broken. No new taxes. But there also are practical problems with the toll and so forth. I think it's a good idea because it brings in money from outside the state, which once again is what we were talking about before in respect to businesses. The gas tax, raising it by a nickel, raises $30 million. There's no reason in the world not to do that. This idea that Connecticut is going to become a place where people from out of state on the way to Boston buy gasoline is not going to happen anyway, because even without raising it, we have a higher tax. We should keep it that way. Use the gas tax to pay for some of this.
Gas taxes, tolls, Colin?
I'm with Danny, actually. Megadittos. First of all, I actually – the other thing about a toll is that it is effectively you're taxing people for the use, right? So people who are actually using this thing and therefore creating various needs are bearing the financial brunt for it. And I think that's fair, too.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about revolving doors at the state capitol. We're going to talk about Dan Malloy endorsing Hillary Clinton. Not a huge surprise there. And who's going to put their naming rights on the Yard Goats new stadium? I'm hoping that Danny Hart has some insight for us when we come back right after this break. Where we live in the wheelhouse. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, just listen to Republican candidates for president of the U.S. You've got a pretty good idea of what modern American conservatism is all about. Lower taxes, smaller government, gun rights, etc. But in Europe, where political, social, economic climates are very different, what does the political right look like? We'll speak with some experts about conservatism in Europe. That's coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, and we're talking with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show here on WNPR, Dan Haar, who's a columnist for The Hartford Courant, and Sue Haig, who's a political reporter for The Associated Press. Got to go through a lightning round because a lot of things we haven't talked about. Governor Malloy is going to sign a casino bill. Are we going to know a little bit more about what's happening with casino expansion, Sue, in the state?
The tribes are very excited that he's going to be signing this. They said that they are going to start putting together their memorandum of understanding that will probably be posted on the Department of Consumer Protection's website. And they're hoping then that towns that are interested in hosting this satellite casino will then apply. And then theoretically, they would have to return to the legislature, and maybe next session we might be dealing with this all over again.
And any change on what we know about Keno being in the budget? I mean, there's still all these worries about can we actually make Keno work in a state where we have these tribal gaming facilities? We're building maybe more tribal gaming facilities. Is Keno still something that's going to happen?
It was in the budget bill. It's something that the Connecticut Lottery Corporation really wants because they believe that it's a way for them to compete also with other states that offer Keno. It's kind of the same argument in a way that the tribes are making. And also they say it's a way for them to continue to provide a steady stream of revenue to the state.
And I know we've sort of beaten this to death, Colin, over the years, but the tribes are very excited. But now we're going to wait for probably at least a year to have this casino be built somewhere between Hartford and I don't know, Enfield, so that it's going to keep people from going to the Springfield Casino. That's not soon enough, right? I mean, we need to capture all these people before they start gambling in Springfield.
Well, yeah, no, it can't be far enough away to make me happy. But so I think the thing to watch now, watch the process in these towns too, and watch how, you know, municipal leaders are wooed and lured toward this idea. I will just quickly – one quick anecdotal thing, which is that on Saturday I went down, as I sometimes do, to make an ill-considered boxed exacta bet on the Belmont Stakes. And you go to this place, which is very ironically called Winners, down in the meadows, the South Meadows of Hartford. And it's, you know, one is reminded that these are not places of great happiness or where, you know – you go for joy. You go to probably do some things that are not in your best interest.
Did you
no,
win?
No, I got killed.
You got okay. Well, maybe this somewhat colors.
Yeah,
it.
I have a jaundiced
view.
Yeah.
If you'd won $10,000, everything would have been rosy.
Right.
Of
you
course.
Could probably throw out my comments.
Coming back
prejudiced.
From Winners.
I think Sportech does a pretty good job of running those places. Actually, they've done they've done a nice job of improving and upgrading the various OTB locations, including the one you mentioned and the one up in. At Bradley Airport, but
now there's sad people there.
Well, sometimes yes. As opposed to in newsrooms.
Moving on, Governor Malloy announced that CT Fast Track will expand east of the river into East Hartford and Manchester, part of his bigger 30-year transportation plan.
These are important announcements. They're important developments. They're important successes. And they speak well of the level of investment that we need to make in Connecticut's infrastructure.
Very quickly on this, Colin, I'll just say that as we talk about a 30-year, or as Danny joked, about a 100-year transportation plan that could cost $100 billion, at the end of the day, the Fast Track does seem like something that, as the governor talks about expanding it east of the river, it's already had some ridership gains. It seems as though he's able to talk about transportation while something is actually being shown to be working.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this really was such an incredible target, CT Fast Track, for the spit of all kinds of people. Perfectly reasonable people talked about it like this is this horrible, horrible boondoggle. Well, it seems like it's going to work. It'll be a lot easier to expand east of the river because they're not going to do the kind of infrastructure. It won't be a dedicated thing. They'll use HOV lanes and stuff like that. It should be an easy thing to do. And you know, may make a pretty big difference, too. To me, that's one of the really big problems is getting people back and forth across the river.
Are you a Fast Track advocate, Danny?
Well, it's not worth what was paid for it, but once it's in place and that cost is sunk, it's a pretty good asset.
Moving on, former House Minority Leader Larry Cafaro has a new gig, going to be the Executive Director and General Counsel for the Wine and Spirits Wholesalers of Connecticut. This is not the first time that someone's left a top legislative job and moved on directly into the world of, well, sort of something that he was just writing laws about not too long ago. Should we be terribly surprised about this, Colin?
Well, I mean, look, I like Larry Cafaro a lot, and he's a very amusing guy, but I mean, look, to me, it's not a big movement because while he was in the legislature and a minority leader, he was working for – was a partner in, I believe, one of the largest lobbying firms in Connecticut and in the Northeast. I always felt like he should recuse himself from almost all legislation based on that. So, no, I'm not surprised to see this. I don't know how it will affect. One of the things that didn't get passed was the thing that allows the liquor stores, the big liquor stores, to do the sort of price liquor or certain things at lower than what they paid for it. They didn't get that this time. I don't know whether that organization lobbies for or against that. I assume for it, though.
Yeah, there's this whole issue about minimum bottle pricing.
That's what I was trying to say.
Please don't make me try to explain, but that didn't make it into the package. But it is something that Governor Malloy has been very interested in, making changes to our liquor laws. I think the only thing that really made it into the package were allowing sales to expand like another hour or something. Mm-hmm.
An important thing to note here is that Larry Cafaro, as a legislative leader moving almost directly into a job like this, he follows a path that has included many, many Democrats over the years, too, Danny. I mean, this is something that we see over and over again, right? The Republicans, Democrats, you leave a top job at the state capitol, and you move right into, a really nice gig like this.
His very former firm has its lobbying headed up by the former Speaker Ritter. So that was a bipartisan effort, which prevented him from having to recuse himself.
In a surprise to no one, Governor Malloy made his presidential endorsement formal. He's backing former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
I'm making a judgment about who I think is ready to be president of the United States, who has the experience necessary to be president of the United States. And I think it's time to choose the most experienced individual.
I got one of these emails, Sue, over the weekend, just a single word in the subject line, hey. And I open it up, and it's from Dan Malloy. He says, hey, I've got a big announcement coming up. And then this big announcement is that he's endorsing Hillary Clinton. And, of course, a lot of breathless coverage around this, that this is indeed big news. I don't know. Should we see this as really big news?
Well, he did endorse her last time. So, and also, you know, he's going to be the chairman of the Democratic Governors Association. So I think that's probably one of the reasons why he is making such a big deal out of it, because he will be sort of a national player coming up in the next campaign.
A national player trying to raise lots of money around Hillary Clinton running for president. Should we be surprised, Colin?
No, I mean, I think, you know, there are a lot of interesting things to watch about Dan Malloy in terms of how he positions himself. I think there are only 18 Democratic governors in all of the United States right now. So, I mean, the playing field's kind of good for him to call attention to himself. I don't know that he's exactly bargaining or positioning for some kind of job in an administration. I think the job he wants right now is kind of, you know, designated loudmouth on some of the national issues. I think he enjoys that kind of attention. He and Morning Joe have apparently broken up. But other than that, I think he likes that role.
Transportation Secretary. Somebody at the Current made that speculation, and that's what he's bucking for. And it would make sense considering that he's basically throwing away the store, in order to get all these.
I don't think that's how he would choose to put it.
Billions of dollars into transportation. He'll have that platform in 2017 on January 20th, if and when Hillary Clinton is inaugurated.
Okay, so last thing, we got a couple minutes left. Later today, officials from the Hartford Yard Goats. Yes, that's still the name of the baseball team that's coming to Hartford. The minor league team will be unveiling the corporate sponsor of the new stadium being built in Hartford. You've been conjecturing, Dan. I mean, what do you think? Who's going to be sponsoring this?
Well, it's more fun conjecturing what the comments on my column this morning are. GE Stadium, Insolvency Stadium, Waste Management Stadium. Those are the joke names. But actually, we know it's going to be a national brand. Somebody suggested Dunkin' Donuts, which does have stadiums.
They do have stadiums.
And so we're looking at a consumer brand rather than a local company like Aetna or United Technologies and those sort of things, both because the companies here have not quite stepped up to back the Yard Goats, and also because that's the trend in stadiums.
But in a somewhat serious vein, though, I mean, is there some company that's been talking about moving out of the area, or some company that needs something from the city or needs something from the state that actually could end up with their name on this stadium because of a nice deal?
Amazon.
That would be my guess.
Amazon.
Too, yeah.
So Amazon Stadium.
Yeah.
Okay.
Amazon.
So Amazon Stadium. You have some thoughts about this, Colin?
Well, I think a nice promotion would be one night per season the Amazon drones could play the humans in baseball. But no, I actually, when I read Danny's article today, and I hang on every word of Danny's articles, the Amazon name jumped out at me. That makes total sense for a whole bunch of reasons.
Are there naming rights for the beautiful little stadium down in Norwich where you live, Sue?
No, I think it's still named after former Senator Thomas Dodd.
Yeah, it's still Dodd Stadium.
Yeah.
So I actually have – this is my one, Colin. I think that you'll like this. You know a lot about our farms and farmers markets. Beltane Farms, they make the best goat cheese in Connecticut. I think that they – should pony up the money right now, and they should have their name, Beltane Farms Stadium in Hartford.
We've actually had one of their goats in studio. I'd like to point that out. But I don't know. You're picking winners in the cheese world, John. It's a very, very dangerous thing.
Yeah, yeah. I remember what happened when that when
Kato Corners is going to be emailing you as you're walking out of the studio.
When the goat came in the studio call, and I remember what happened to our carpet.
Right.
That is a story that we will never forget. I want to thank Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, who will be speaking Esperanto at 1 o'clock. Thank you, Colin. Thanks also to Sue Haig. She's a political reporter for the Associated Press. Sue, I hope you'll come back. I hope we didn't scare you off.
Never coming back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also, thanks to Dan Haar. He's a columnist for the Hartford Current. Thank you so much, Danny.
Thank you.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives with Lydia Brown, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyle Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Our interns for the program, Hallie St. Germain, Alex Dubin, Allison Ehrenreich, Nicole Wetzman, Charlie Smart. You can continue the conversation at WNPR.org/where we live.